May I present to you the Dean of the School of Theology, who will present a member of the Theology School faculty for the faculty address. It is a custom of this institution that reaches back across the years for each member of the faculty. At some point, I started to say early in his association with the seminary, but in recent years, the number of faculty additions have sometimes moved that date several years later than the joining of the faculty. But it is a tradition for each member of the faculty to speak to the community in terms of his own professional background and specialization. Therefore, following that tradition, I present to you Dean Roy Lee Honeycutt to introduce the speaker of this occasion.
I'm pleased to introduce to you this morning in a formal way, although you know him already, my colleague and friend, Dr. James Blevins, who has been a member of this faculty since 1976. Dr. Blevins completed his AB degree at Duke University in 1958. He completed his first professional degree, the BD degree, at Eastern Baptist Seminary in Philadelphia in 1961. At that time, he did a year of study at the German Baptist Seminary in Hamburg, Germany. He returned in 1962 and received in that year the THM degree from Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary. He received his PhD degree from this institution in 1965. He has spent five summers in graduate study in Germany at Göttingen, Tübingen, Munich, Marburg, and Münster from 1971 through 75. He has served as the minister of a church. He served as instructor of New Testament in this institution from 1962 through 1968, as professor of religion at Mars Hill College from 1969 through 1976, and as I have indicated, since 1976, has served as associate professor of New Testament interpretation. I present you to him as one well equipped to address us at this time and to present to us his faculty address. Jim? We're pleased to hear you.
I'd like to express my appreciation to Dr. Andy Rawls of the library staff and the library staff for aiding me in the visual presentation here this morning. The title of my faculty address is The Genre of Revelation. Scholars find it difficult to pinpoint the peculiar literary genre of the Book of Revelation. Recent studies have shown the relationship of Hellenistic biographies to the genre of our New Testament Gospels. Less recent work has demonstrated the affinities between Greek letter-writing style and that of Paul. However, the genre of Revelation remains elusive. Charles Talbert, a specialist in genre studies, recently stated, quote, "Someone needs to establish a credible genre for the Book of Revelation," end of quote. It is usually assumed by researchers that Revelation belongs to the literary Gattung of apocalyptic literature. In reality, however, it was Revelation which gave its name to the other apocalypses. In fact, the dissimilarities between Revelation and the other apocalypses are becoming more and more evident. Such essential themes as pseudonymity, secrecy, historical periodization are not utilized by Revelation. Unlike other apocalypses, it demonstrates a close affinity to the Hebrew prophetic literature and quotes extensively from it. We wish to contend that the genre of Revelation is a syncretistic one, setting forth a prophetic message in the form of Greek tragic drama. An author communicates not only by means of a shared genre, but also through modification of that genre. Previous research. The name of John Wick Bowman is most closely attached to an attempt to link Revelation to Greek tragedy. However, Bowman, in his book, The First Christian Drama, published in 1955, did not have as his purpose to give an in-depth study of the forms or content of Greek tragedy. At most, he proposed that Revelation be divided into seven acts with seven scenes in each act. His major contribution was in demonstrating the instructions which the writer gave within the text for the stage settings of the Revelation drama. The bulk of his abbreviated work was devoted to establishing the sevenfold division of the book. He wrote it for laymen with the intent of introducing them to viewing Revelation as drama. He did nothing with the Greek stage, chorus, or the leading motifs and forms of Greek drama. To offset this weakness, Bowman also published the same year in Interpretation an article which he deemed an apologia to the scholarly world and which he attempted to give more attention to the details of Greek drama. Again, however, most of the article was devoted to a defense of his seven acts, seven scenes division of the text. Near the end of that essay, he mentioned briefly the significance of the Greek stage and its design. Unfortunately, these two works are usually the only ones summarized or critiqued when the subject of Greek drama and Revelation is encountered. Without substantial facts and supports, the dramatic theme in Revelation, as presented by Bowman, is often dismissed as novel or cute. It is interesting also to note that many Revelation scholars assume that Bowman has said all that needs to be said on the subject. Bowman's best work was done in the article on Revelation in the Interpreter's Dictionary of the Bible. There he endeavored for the first time to take a serious look at all aspects of Greek drama. Yet again, he neglected the uniqueness of the stage at Ephesus, the role of the chorus, and the construction of the tragedies themselves. Thus, even though the idea of Revelation as Greek tragedy seems like an idea which has been with us a long time, it is evident that it has never really been explored. Other work that has been done in the area, which we will not have time to deal with here this morning, would be articles by Brewer and Palmer in relating Revelation to Greek tragedy. Let us begin by asking the question, why would the writer of Revelation have chosen Greek tragedy as a form for his prophetic visions? Martin Hengel, in his pace-setting book, Judaism and Hellenism, has shown the overwhelming influence of the Greek world on Judaism. The Greek way had been solidly in control for 300 years before the birth of Christ. Indeed, Hengel viewed apocalyptic literature as a byproduct of the struggle of Judaism with Hellenism in the period 150 years before Christ. He asserted, quote, "It is no coincidence that the first great apocalypses came from the time of the Hellenistic reform and the persecutions and freedom fights that proceeded from it," end of quote. Yet, even though apocalyptic stemmed from reaction to Greek culture, it was couched in Hellenistic forms and patterns. Elsewhere in New Testament studies, we have learned that those who fought Gnosticism had to borrow Gnostic terminology. Many apocalyptic scholars have pointed to the Greek idea of the periodizing of history, which was absorbed into the Jewish apocalypses. Although heavily indebted to these prior works, the Jewish apocalypses, John, writing from Asia Minor in the heart of Greek culture, made even greater use of Greek forms and motifs. Ephesus was a major center of Greek culture. 37 Greek theaters have been excavated in Asia Minor alone, including one in six of the seven cities of Revelation. Indeed, the largest theater in the Greek world was at Ephesus, holding 25,000 people. Philostratus related that Greek tragedy was performed in these theaters. In a Hellenistic center such as Ephesus, the themes of the major Greek dramas were well known among the general population and thus a real part of the culture of converts to Christianity. Indeed, drama was intricately related to their religious and feast days. Fiorenza, an outstanding scholar in Revelation, has said, quote, "In Greek tragedy, the roots of drama and cult are closely interconnected," end of quote. Therefore, the writer of Revelation selected a genre that had lent a dramatic overtone to the older Jewish apocalypses and made even greater use of it in the Ephesian community. This accounts at once for the similarities and dissimilarities with the other apocalypses. It became for him a syncretistic vessel into which he poured many Old Testament words of prophecy. Yet the outer form of Greek drama made the prophetic message more appealing to a Greek community. Indeed, recent structuralist studies in Revelation have demonstrated that the actantial level of the book confirms the prophetic, apocalyptic, judgment, salvation pattern as the basis for the work. One such structuralist, Fiorenza, concluded, quote, "It is especially interesting to note the affinity of the structure of Revelation to that of Greek drama. According to the compositional rules of the tragedy, the climax falls near the center of the action, and the denouement comes near the end," end of quote. That pattern falls in an ABCDCBA sequence. Within that sequence, there is prophetic movement from promise to fulfillment. The Greek dramatic form sets forth a cosmic, timeless drama setting for the prophetic teaching. We see early Christian prophecy utilizing the patterns and language of Greek tragedy to admonish and interpret the situation of the community. The Greek apocalypses lack this prophetic interest, the Jewish apocalypses lack this prophetic interest, and the subsequent need for an internal structure of Greek tragedy. It is time that a serious study be made of this genre and its influence on the writer of Revelation. This address will be limited to three areas: the Ephesian theater, the chorus, and the form of Greek tragedy. The Ephesian theater. In all previous work relating Revelation to Greek tragedy, the uniqueness of the Ephesian theater has been completely ignored. This theater was located in the very heart of the city at the intersection of the city's two principal streets. You can see it here in the picture over to the left side. From its mountainside location, it was the first building viewed by visitors as they sailed into the harbor. The theater was built on the slopes of Mount Panayirdog in the 3rd century BC. Thus, for over 300 years, the great Greek tragedies and comedies had been enacted upon its stage. This is the rear view facing the harbor. Historians of Greek drama are puzzled by one unique aspect of the stage building in this theater. To understand that uniqueness, we must look at the basic parts of a Greek theater using the Ephesian stage as our model. On the lower level was a circular orchestra. Directly behind the orchestra lay the skene, or scene, building. In its earliest days, 3rd century BC, it had been a wooden structure. By the 1st century AD, it had become a permanent stone edifice. The proscenium jutted out from the scene building to form a raised platform or stage 8.5 feet above the orchestra level and 10 feet deep. The upper portion of the skene was called the episkenion. It usually contained 3 to 5 openings for the scenery in Greek drama. These openings were called theromata. Pillars 1.5 meters wide separated each theroma from the next. The Ephesian stage had 7 such openings. It has been the only Greek stage ever excavated with 7 theromata, or 7 windows. Thus, for nearly 300 years before the writing of Revelation, the number 7 had acquired great significance for the inhabitants of Ephesus. The number 7 has long been recognized as a significant number in the book of Revelation. We have already seen that Bowman divided the book into 7 acts with 7 scenes in each act. He quite likely found this division in Ernst Lohmeyer's outstanding commentary on Revelation, published in 1926. There, Lohmeyer declared, "The forming principle of the work, at once the measure of its construction, is the number 7 which rules in all of its smaller and larger parts." Of course, the number 7 also had symbolic significance as the divine number of the ancient world. The unique construction of the Ephesian stage also confirms the fact that 7 had even greater significance for the Ephesian community. Every time a festival gathering was held there, the number 7 was before the populace. The 7 windows were the dominant feature of the architect of the theater building. The main purpose of these windows, or theromata, was to affect the presentation of scenery in Greek drama. Painted panels were placed in the windows, depicting scenes too difficult to perform on stage. This suits well many of the scenes in Revelation. In addition, revolving sets called exyclama could be placed in the windows and be turned to show 3, 5, or 7 additional scenes. At times, these exyclama were rolled out onto the platform, adding another dimension to the drama. Thus, the 7 windows of the Ephesian stage had a direct bearing on the way the great tragic dramas were presented in that theater. They also seem to have had the same effect on the organization of Revelation. Above the windows was also the very top of the scene building. This area was also reserved for the abode of the gods. A machine, a type of crane, would transport messengers from the gods down to the proscenium level. In many of the extant Greek tragedies, the final solution to the drama is brought by means of a god coming down to solve the dilemma. This crane-like machine used for transporting divine figures came to be called the Deus Ex Machina, the god from the machine. In these stage settings, one notices the frequent use of the altar. In the Greek theaters, including the one at Ephesus, a permanent altar stood in the middle of the orchestra in honor of the god Dionysus. A Greek theater was considered sacred ground, and all who participated, actors, chorus, patrons, were considered ministers of religion. Author Fairbanks once stated, quote, "Greek tragedy and comedy are the natural response to the Greek demand for the enrichment of worship by art," end of quote. The technical word used for bringing out a play was thithoskene, to teach. And the director was called thithoskalos, teacher. And the plays themselves were termed thithoskalia, teaching. Thus, John's community would have found much about Greek drama already a part of their religious heritage and a good background for understanding their new one. The chorus. The role of the chorus in Greek tragedy and comedy has been neglected, along with the significance of the stage at Ephesus. The chorus, composed of either 12 or 24 men, entered the theater on either side of the skene through the parados. You see in the lower portions of the picture on the left and right, the parados for the entrance of the chorus. Alzinger has said at this point, the chorus, quote, "represented the objective intention of the author and offered comments on the events on stage," end of quote. The chorus could represent, for instance, wasps, birds, frogs, goats, snakes, bees, fish, storks, or human figures. These representations could be done by assuming masks. Gilbert Murray called the chorus that most wonderful of Greek dramatic instruments. Phrynichus, 476 BC, in his drama used a chorus made up of elders who commented sagely on the actions on the stage. In most of the Greek tragedies, the chorus was friendly to the main character. The chorus was the most important aspect of the Greek tragedy, interpreting the musical phrases and songs and the action of the play for the audience. They were usually positioned in a semicircle around the throne of Dionysius, directly in front of the permanent altar. In fact, the earliest tragedies had only choruses and no actors. The chorus could also be divided into groups of 2 or 4 with a leader appointed for each group. Duets could be sung between choral leader, the coryphaeus, and the chorus. In time, the choral leaders became actors, and the chorus became less important in tragedy. The plays of Aeschylus and Sophocles gave to the chorus a very strategic role. The chorus could sing and chant accompanied by lyres or harps, which they carried. They chanted in measured antiphonal strains, balanced strophe and antistrophe. Klaus Peter Jerns, in his book Das Hymnische Evangelium, has made a study of the construction, function, and origin of the hymns of Revelation. Although Jerns was not coming to this task from the point of Greek drama, He did discover that the hymns of Revelation display this balanced strophe antistrophe construction. The striking impression led the structuralist Fiorenza to say, quote, "Recent studies of the hymnic materials in Revelation have convincingly demonstrated that the hymns comment and complement the visions and auditions of the book. They function thus in the same way as the choruses in the Greek drama, preparing and commenting upon the dramatic movements of the plot," end of quote. The form of Greek tragedy. Another aspect of the case for the impact of Greek tragedy on Revelation, which has been overlooked, is the form and construction of Greek tragedy. Bowman mentioned it briefly in his article in the Interpreter's Dictionary of the Bible. If this dramatic genre is to be taken seriously for Revelation studies, then we must understand how a Greek tragedy was constructed. Many Revelation commentators have rejected the genre of Greek tragedy by pointing out that Revelation has no actors and defined speaking parts. Yet not all Greek tragedies had them. The typical Greek tragedy was divided into definite parts. The play begins with a prologue, which was done in the form of a monologue or a dialogue. This was true in some of Euripides' plays. One character acquainted the audience with the necessary background information for the play. This type of prologue is found in Revelation 1, 1 through 8. John represents in monologue form the background information for the drama. After the prologue, the chorus entered the stage by way of the parados, usually singing. They do so in Revelation, singing the hymn passages in 1, 6 through 8, punctuated with the dual amens. They remained on stage in the Greek dramas to comment on and interpret the following events. After the entrance of the chorus, the first episode took place. It was composed of dialogue with no more than three actors, or a monologue followed by a stasimon or a choral ode. This basic pattern, episode, stasimon, was repeated 3, 5, or 7 times. Revelation fits the sevenfold pattern, as demonstrated by Lohmeyer and the stage of Ephesus itself. Following the last episode, the exodus of the chorus took place, and then the epilogue. A survey of Greek tragedies indicates that some were basically plays with one actor, and the chorus filling in with responses or a variety of other roles. Aeschylus' earliest extant work, The Suppliants, was such a one-actor play. The main character, the king, and the chorus interpreted and carried on the action from verses 234 through 480. Instead of acts, the Greeks used the word part, which denoted merely division of the play as determined by choral divertissement, whether written or interpolated. Revelation can be divided into 7 such parts or acts. The stage setting. Let us now attempt to determine how the stage setting of Revelation related to the specific situation of the 7-window stage at Ephesus. This is the uniqueness about the stage. The text of Revelation, as Bowman rightly demonstrated, contains the instructions for these stage settings. However, neither he nor anyone else has attempted to relate these to the unique stage at Ephesus. At the same time, I will give my division of the 7 acts of the drama. The drama begins with the 8-verse prologue, followed by the stage setting for Act 1. Act 1, the 7 church visions. The stage building represents the temple with a focus upon the holy place. In verses 12 through 20, John describes the stage setting, 7 gold candlesticks with the Son of Man standing in their midst. A candlestick representing a church is in each of the 7 windows of the Ephesus stage. Quite likely, these would be the 7-branch menorah. As each window is open, this message is read to that church. In the midst of the candlesticks, on the episkinion level, the Son of Man figure dressed in white would stand. After each letter, the chorus located on the orchestra level responds with, quote, "Hear what the Spirit says to the churches." Act 2, the 7 seal visions. The setting is the throne room of God. We will return in a moment to this act and use it as an example of how a full act would be staged in the Ephesian theater. Act 3, the seven trumpet visions. The stage building continues to represent the heavenly temple. The permanent altar already on stage becomes the altar of incense in the Holy of Holies. Seven angels appear with seven trumpets. Each is stationed in front of one of the seven windows. As each trumpet is sounded, the painting depicting that scene is revealed in the windows. Act 4. The seven visions of the Lamb and Beast in conflict. The stage setting is found in 1119. The veil of the curtain leading into the Holy of Holies is open. The audience can see the Ark of the Covenant, the symbol of God's faithfulness in the midst of the conflict. Seven different views of this conflict are presented in the seven windows. The chorus interprets the action with a hymn in 12:10b through 12. The episode ends with the Stasimon or choral ode in 15:3b through 4. Act 5, the seven bowl visions. The stage setting is found in 15:5 through 8. The veil of the Holy of Holies remains open. Seven angels dressed as high priests come out of the inner temple, the door of the lower stage, and proceed to the proscenion, the jutted out section of the stage, to pour out their bowls of wrath over the edge of the stage onto the face of the earth. One angel is stationed in front of each window. As each bowl is poured out, the picture representing that plague is placed in the window. The Stasimon is found in 16:5b through 7. Act 6, the seven vision of Babylon's fall. The stage setting is found in 17:1 through 3. The proscenion is designed as a desert place. The seven-headed scarlet beast is represented by a masked figure. In the background in the windows are scenes of Rome going up in flames. The Stasimon is found in 18:2 through 20 and 19:1 through 8. Finally, Act 7, the seven visions of victory. The stage setting is found in 19:11. Heaven is open. The word of God appears on a white horse. The last struggle takes place. The millennial reign of Christ occurs. John is then shown the New Jerusalem. The city is depicted in the seven windows. The Stasimon is found in 21:6 through 8. The epilogue in seven verses then follows in 22:6 through 11. So in brief form, those are the stage settings for the seven acts as they would have appeared on that unique stage in Ephesus. Now we want to go back to Act 2 and complete that in a full sense of the word here, Act 2. We will now demonstrate in Act 2 in full how this would have appeared on the Ephesus stage. The stage setting is outlined in chapters 4 and 5 of Revelation. In 4:1, John sees a door open in heaven. It is God's throne room, quite likely the holy place in the temple. The Jews believed the Jerusalem temple was just a model of the perfect one in heaven. And behind each of the acts in Revelation, you will see some form of the temple. This act is located on the orchestra level, where the permanent throne and altar were located on the Ephesian stage. As in Greek drama, the Revelation chorus is also located there and has a more prominent role in this act than any other. God's throne is veiled by reflection of jewel-like radiance. A dark green rainbow is around the throne. There are 24 smaller thrones around God's throne, and the 24 members of the chorus are on these. Four living creatures are by God's throne. They are depicted by other chorus members wearing the four masks of a lion, an ox, a man, and an eagle. Seven lamps stand before the throne, representing the Spirit of God. A sea of glass separates earth from heaven. As we come to these important hymns in Revelation, and to demonstrate the importance of the Greek chorus, my Greek class will sing in Greek the strophe, antistrophe form of the Greek chorus. We will have the English on the screen for you to follow along. We can get our lights. We'll proceed with the chorus. Four chorus members representing the four living creatures introduce the first Stasimon, or choral ode. It is composed of two stanzas. This is followed by the antiphonal ode in four stanzas. Full chorus of 24 then get up from their thrones and cast their crowns before him and sing a four stanza hymn. As the singing fades away, a scroll sealed with seven seals is seen in the hand of God. An angel asks, "Who is worthy to open the scroll?" No one is found. John begins to weep. A member of the chorus chants, "Weep not, lo, the lion of the tribe of Judah, the root of David, hath conquered, so that he can open the scroll and its seven seals." A cast member using a face mask representing a lamb appears on stage. This occasions a second stanza of the hymn sung to God in 4:11, but it's now addressed to the Lamb. It is composed of five verses. Again, axios, worthy art thou to take the scroll. The chorus then is transformed into a chorus of angels and another stanza in three verses of the axios hymn. Worthy is the Lamb who was slain to receive power and wealth and wisdom and might. The chorus takes on another form, and the whole universe now joins in the three-verse, four-stanza of the worthy hymn. And just as the action is ready to begin, the whole stage is just resounding in music, the whole universe is joined in, worthy is the Lamb that was slain. And the Lamb steps up and takes the scroll and breaks open the first seal as the four living creatures say, Amen. I just feel that needs to be dramatized somewhere. Scene one. As the music fades away, the Lamb opens the first seal. This first scene is depicted in the first window of the Episcopion, a painting of a white horse. The second seal is broken. Scene two. The Lamb opens the second seal, and a painting of a red horse is placed in window two. Scene three, the third seal is open, and the black horse is depicted in window three. Scene four, the pale green horse, is represented in window four. Scene five, the fifth seal is broken. This scene brings a view of the Christian martyrs under the altar in front of God's throne. This scene appears in window five. The chorus gathers at the permanent altar on the stage, representing here the high altar sacrifice and chants. O sovereign Lord, holy and true, how long before thou wilt judge and avenge our blood on them that dwell upon the earth? 6:10. White robes are given to the martyrs, and they are told to rest until their number is complete. Scene six, the sixth seal is open. As the sixth seal is broken, a painting of world destruction and judgment is placed in the sixth window of the Ephesian stage. The moon is red like blood, and the sun is black like sackcloth. The stars are shown falling out of the sky. All of the symbolic depictions of world judgment found in the Old Testament apocalypses appear here. An interlude then takes place. Four angels are told to hold back God's wind of destruction until 144,000 are sealed. This number is composed of 12 times 12, a number symbolizing wholeness. This action is depicted on the orchestra level as 12 members of the chorus, by the way, called elders as well, are marked on the forehead. The interlude comes to an end with the chorus breaking out into a four-verse song. Amen, blessing and glory and wisdom and thanksgiving and honor and power and might be unto our God forever and ever. Amen. And scene seven then takes place as the seventh seal is broken. Seven angels emerge from window seven onto the proscenium. A suspenseful 1/2 hour of silence ensues to bring Act Two to an end. It is evident that the dramatic medium is a suitable one for the message proclaimed in this act. The first four seal visions depict the kind of world in which Christians must live, a world of conquering, warfare, famine, and death. These four horses have been seen on the world stage over and over again. In the midst of that, as Seal 5 portrays, Christians will suffer and experience martyrdom. The Christians might well ask, "How long, O Lord, before you punish those who afflict us?" The answer is given that world judgment will not come until the number who will die for Christ have been completed. However, in Seal 6, the martyrs are shown a preview of what the judgment will be like, using the typical apocalyptic symbols. The interlude is also designed to assure the Christians that they have been sealed. They are under God's care, 144,000 representing the complete number. They may suffer and die, but God's wrath will fall only on the unrighteous. In the seventh seal, seven angels appear, bearing the prayers of God's people. In the midst of this suffering and death, God is aware of the needs of his own. He hears their prayers. Thus we have seen in the midst of a cosmic drama, a timeless vision, yet it is set within the prophetic scheme of promise and fulfillment. Conclusion, we conclude that the writer Revelation adapted the genre of Greek tragedy because it was a vessel through which his community could interpret its experiences in a troubled time. He wanted to stun them with the power of his images and visions. They incite not just an intellectual response, but also an emotional reaction. This dramatic medium allows for the wealth of colors and voices and symbols to emerge. The book just comes alive. The writer took the form or genre of Greek drama and filled it with prophetic oracles, announcements of judgment, proclamations of salvation, drawn largely from the Old Testament. Charles Talbert made the important point, quote, "The Gospels are biographies, howbeit ancient ones. This contention no more denies the creative deviations from Mediterranean conventions by the evangelists than does the claim that Paul's writings are letters rule out his innovative adaptation of that genre," end of quote. We can also conclude the same in Revelation. It represents an innovative adaptation of Greek tragic drama. This accounts for its striking difference from other so-called apocalyptic books. Bowman and others did not take sufficient note of this innovative modification of the Greek tragedy genre in Revelation. The writer was not able to express his visual experience in ordinary prose. He needed a dramatic medium. The timeless, poetic forms of Greek tragedy were well suited to capture his cosmic visions of another world. Yet the cyclical nature of Greek history, found in Greek tragedy, is transformed by him into a prophetic, goal-oriented view of history. The wedding of the timeless and the prophetic in Revelation presents us with a spiral scheme of history, movement in half circles toward the end goal. Above all, the Greek dramas were religious experiences involving liturgy and festivity. In fact, many recent studies have demonstrated how the dramatic forms of Revelation were used in early Christian liturgy and festivity. Drama and divine worship were closely related in the minds of the first century Greek world. The Greek tragedy was a medium well known in Asia Minor and in particular in Ephesus. The theater in that great city had been both a landmark and a cultural center. Only in that setting can the unique genre of Revelation be understood. Indeed, it is a true syncretistic vessel bringing together the Greek and Hebraic worlds, theater and temple, cult and drama. This dramatic genre also allows the book to capture the imagination of modern readers. I've had very good reaction in the local churches to this kind of approach to the book of Revelation because the book becomes alive for people. They see what John saw. They feel what he felt. It can provide the layman an alternative to the Hal Lindsey School and his dispensational views. The dramatic medium has the power to grasp an individual where he is and confront him with a prophetic message. We are already participating in the power of God's rule, and in that rule we can be victorious over all the dehumanizing evil powers of our world. On the last page of the book of Revelation stands the triumphant Lamb, not Caesar nor any ism. The purpose of this address has been to establish the unique literary genre of Revelation. The key to this endeavor has been Greek tragedy. The idea has been with us for a long time, but is one which has never been adequately explored. I have sought to give support to the idea by examining the unique seven-windowed stage at Ephesus, the nature of the chorus in Greek drama, and the structure of Greek tragedy. Lastly, the settings for the seven acts of Revelation have been located on the Ephesian stage, and Act Two has been completely staged. Additional work needs to be done in relating Revelation to the tragic drama. In January 1977, we produced Revelation in dramatic form in the course which I taught on the book. My next project and dream is to go to this setting and to that theater to take a group of students and film Revelation as Greek tragedy on the stage that was there in John's day and time. Now I ask Dr. McCall to conclude in prayer.
I think you want to express appreciation for participation in a unique experience that will print itself on your memory and I venture have an effect upon your proclamation of the gospel. Would you like to express appreciation to Dr.